Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And today, we're talking about Arcadia 4. Arcadia 4 came out a few weeks ago, but we had recorded a few episodes in advance because we knew we weren't going to be able to record. Now this is the first episode that we're recording since it was released, and we're excited to talk about it. So, Ariel, I think you were particularly interested in the letter from the editor.
Yeah, my favorite part about the letter from the editor was that we got to get a really good sense of what the future of Arcadia is going to look like, because we get some answers actually from a survey that was put out. And what we found is that 90% of the people that read Arcadia are GMs. I don't think this is too surprising, because I think MCDM's best content, the whole Running the Game series, is really catered towards GMs. So this kind of makes sense. But there was also a statistic that 70% of the people reading Arcadia don't play at all. For whatever reason, they are always the GM. And I thought that was really interesting too. So we can see that in the future, Arcadia is going to be really focused on running the game and the experience of design from a GM perspective. What are some of the other things they found that were interesting? They also took a look at which articles were the most well received. And what they found was that the adventures were not as well received as the building blocks for the adventures, such as stat blocks or encounters or magic items. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of those kinds of things in the future. That last point made me a little sad. Ray and I talked a lot about the laboratory adventure, where you get to go through a kind of 2001 A Space Odyssey almost encounter, where the whole laboratory around you has a personality, and you can work with them or against them. And to me, that created a kind of inspiration that I think I don't get from just a magic item. It gave me a whole new idea to play with and fit into my game. And I really liked that, and so I'll be a little sad to see some of that content go. Ray, did you think that any of these findings for you were surprising, or are you excited about the future of a more GM-focused Arcadia?
I was surprised by the feedback. The workshop watches, I felt, was particularly excellent. It seemed like a very different type of Dungeons & Dragons, very like Colvillian style of running the game that I really enjoyed, and I really enjoyed getting a really crisp example of what like a full adventure in that style looks like, to kind of like pick and choose the pieces of it that I enjoyed. I also had the privilege of running that adventure, and it worked out really great, and we got through the entire adventure in, I think, like 3.5 hours. So I just thought that adventure was really crisp, so I'll be sad to see adventures like that one not appear. But the other adventures, I have to agree that there was a lot of content there, a lot of words in those other two adventures that I didn't end up using even pieces of them. So I'm upset to see the best adventures not reappearing, but I am a little bit happy that we're not going to get an adventure in every single issue just for the sake of providing some type of adventure to fill out the issue.
For sure. And I think some of these magic items are extremely inspiring to me, and I look forward to seeing them really focus on some of those as well. Like, we were very inspired by the codices in Strongholds and Followers, and those get to show up again in this episode of Arcadia, so keep an eye out for that. I'm extremely excited for that. And there was also creatures like the elementals that were so exciting and inspiring, even if they were just stat blocks. So I think that's something that, you know, MCDM can continue to create these really world-changing creatures and magic items, even if they're not writing out a full adventure for you, so that you can put these pieces together yourself, which is what the audience apparently is looking for, which I'm okay with. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, definitely. So let's dive into this first article here, which I think might be the article that we were least excited about. So we're going to cut through this one pretty quickly. Swimming Through Sand to See More Mounted Adventuring by Willy Abiel. So this is a kind of like a part two to the mounted combat options we got in the first ever issue of Arcadia, also by Willy Abiel. We loved those mounted combat options. We talk about it in pretty great detail in our review of Arcadia 1. So if you want to know more about what Arcadia has to say about mounted combat, go listen to that episode. They offer 4 new types of mounts to choose from. The Axolot, which can swim, as can the Chull, which they also offer, there's the bullet who can burrow, and then there's also a juvenile purple worm, and that also burrows. So we have swimming and burrowing mounts in this issue of Arcadia. There are kind of more stat blocks, and each of them has an ability that is specific to the type of creature, and they're all very powerful. And you get to use their abilities as bonus actions, which is cool and very powerful and potentially game-breaking. Something else that they released in this issue of Arcadia was magic items that pair with your mount. I believe there's maybe 5 or 6 of these magic items. Oh, wow. Actually, there's like 10 magic items. Ariel, which of these magic items that you can use with a mount did you enjoy the most? Or maybe your top two?
I would say one of the ones that caught my attention was the meld harness. And the reason was because I read the articles about burrowing, and I was like, how the heck am I supposed to DM this? What are you doing when you're on top of a purple worm and you're underground as it's burrowing? I thought for a second maybe you would need to be inside the purple worm taking acid damage to use this feature. But instead we have a magic item. And what this does is you become a part of the creature that you are riding. So it has a little bit of a similar effect to what happens to your clothes when you polymorph. That was kind of the picture I had in my head. And you kind of meld into the thing. There are some really, really cool abilities that go along with this. My favorite one is that the creature that you are riding gains damage resistances, immunities, and special senses that you have. So if you have some, you know, ring of fire resistance, suddenly your purple worm will also be resistant to fire damage. And now you can use immunities and resistances to make your mount even more powerful. And I thought that was a very cool experience. My actual favorite magic item, though, is definitely the Bell of Extra Stable Stable. So it's a silly name, which I think is always really fun for magic items in D&D. You get to tell your player what this is, and they laugh, and they engage, and they remember with it. So what does this do? It creates a portal to an unoccupied space of your choice within 5 feet in front of you. This portal leads to an extra-dimensional, spacious stable with room for up to 8 large creatures to live comfortably. I love this idea that you get to curate your mounts. You get to have your sea mount, your burrowing mount, your flying mount, and you can have them all, and you keep them in a harmonious, beautiful space. They love each other. It's curated and created nicely, maybe like a magical mansion that you might create if you're a high-level wizard. And I just love this idea that you don't have to carry your mounts around with you, and you get to use them in a way that makes the most sense. It's a little bit like a Pokemon or like Bill's PC, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that we see a real theme here with these magic items, which is they're less of how can we make mounts more powerful or cooler, and more of how can we make it more convenient for players to make use of mounts in Dungeons & Dragons, which I think is the main thing that prohibits people from including them in their game, which is like, oh, we need to go into this dungeon. Is my horse just follow us into this dungeon? Am I going to leave it tied up outside the dungeon where it can be attacked by goblins or be noticed by guards, and then all of a sudden we don't have the element of surprise anymore? I think it takes something that is difficult to have a cohesive story around in Dungeons & Dragons and gives you ways to like kind of explain it away or make it easier to have a mount be a big part of your character. One that my favorite magic item, which I think continues on this theme, is the Return Bridle and Crop. This is basically the like Legend of Zelda whistle for your horse, and it magically shows up wherever you are. Magic item where you have a telepathic link with your mount, and if you need your mount for some reason, you once per day can just summon them and teleport them to you. So you show up at the dungeon, it's time for you to go dungeon delving. You can send your horse away to go and graze out in the fields, and you know that when you're done dungeon delving, you can just summon your mount to your side afterwards. So I really enjoyed this item.
Yeah, I was thinking of it from the context of Gandalf and summoning Shadowfax. I think he has this like really like magical whistle that he uses, and Shadowfax always is able to come find him. I really love this magic item too. It's I think, beautiful in a way that you are forming a magical bond with your creature, with your mount.
Yeah, it's very, very thematic and very cinematic as well. And then there's this cool idea at the end of the chapter where it talks about party mounts. So like creatures that are so huge that they can actually ferry your entire party around.
My favorite part about this is not the visual of your whole party riding on some giant creature, which I love. That's great. My favorite part is that the example they use is a named creature. And I love this idea that you are meeting something that is important to the lore of your world. And other people might have heard of this creature. And when you arrive somewhere riding on the back of a named wondrous being, people are going to take notice. They're going to be impressed. It's going to start a reputation for you that you are not to be reckoned with. And I think that's really special. It allows you to engage in the story of the world that the DM is building. And as the DM, it allows you to put in lore, put in connections. We've talked about note-taking that has a lot of different connections to different pieces in it. If you have a note for this giant creature that is known throughout the lands, and you have a lot of different connections to that creature, as soon as your characters meet that creature and make a pact and are able to ride it somewhere, they now have many different connections to lots of different story hooks in your world. You can use this to start another adventure or to have somebody contact the players to look for something.
Yeah, no, it's a great visual. And I think the example that they gave is pretty fun too. If you don't give it a significant enough amount of distance to ferry you, it takes it as like not enough of a challenge, and it like turns on you and attacks you. When you're deciding or whether or not you want to use that creature, the distance has to be large enough to make it worth it for them, which I think is a good way to get around the idea of why aren't you just summoning this creature all the time? No, we're only going to resort to summoning this creature if we have to travel a great expanse. So maybe like to another country or continent.
Yeah, it's another great way to make travel exciting.
Will this distance be far enough, or do we have a combat after this distance that we just asked this creature to ferry us? The next article, which I think might be the article that you're most jazzed about, Ariel, is The Chained Library, A New Location with Creatures, Magic Items, and Stories by Kat Evans.
Yes, this is by far my favorite thing of any Arcadia period. And I think this is just because it would fit into campaigns that I run really well. I always have sentient books. I always have tomes of knowledge put into my campaigns. So this article here is called The Chained Library. And what it is the mythical Library of Alexandria, the great library where all of knowledge is stored, but the magical take on what that would look like. And some of the magics in this place are crazy. In order to get in, you have to be let in. There's almost no way in by yourself. You need a strength check of 30 to get through, or a lockpicking kit of 25 to get through the exterior walls. And then there are much more defenses interior. In order to get out with a book, you need to fight your way out perhaps, but then you get a plague if you steal this book, and this plague cannot be restored. Like, a greater restoration on this plague, if you steal a book, will not be restored. It will just help you in the temporary time where the greater restoration was cast. So there's all these big magical components to a secret library that a lot of, I think, the tropes of secret libraries in history don't have, so you can borrow from here and borrow from history. And then on top of that, there's a list of books in this chained library that I want to put in every game I have. And these books do insane things like rewrite history. There's literally a book where it has the history of the world, and if you change something in the book, it changes in history. And that is berserk. Giving your players that much leverage over your own world is scary, but it's beautiful. I love this idea of your players engaging with the lore of your world because they can change the lore of your world. So they have to read what happened in order to figure out what they need to change to solve their current problem. So I love that component to it. And then the very last thing that is my favorite part of this is that the librarians are not librarians, they're adventurers. Because in order to get these very scary sentient books, they need to adventure for them. So the librarians of the Chained Library are some extremely powerful adventurers that you could encounter out in the world, or you can encounter them in the library, and they are not quaint, they are not quiet, they will mess you up. They are extremely powerful. And I love that subversion of expectations, that librarians are not quiet and quaint, they're adventurers.
Yeah, I think it's a really fitting way for a paladin or a high-level faction agent character to retire. Like, you're at the end of your campaign, your character could decide to retire to this library, and maybe they retire to this library to protect the book that, like, maybe perhaps the Demonomicon. Some book or tome that was the central MacGuffin to your plot. It's a really cool idea that, like, a character could retire to become a librarian or a keeper of this secret chained library. I really appreciate that the writer of this chapter took many pains to, like, think about the things that I often don't see Wizards of the Coast material think about. So whenever you're writing a vault of some kind that has valuable items in it, your players are going to pull out all the stops to try and heist this location. They have access to things like Dimension Door. They have access to things like Stone Shape, which basically just allows them to create doors wherever they want. And this chapter does a really good job of outlining what magical defenses are in place to not completely stop players from successfully heisting the library, but certainly to impede them and to cause them trouble after they successfully escape with whatever it is that they were trying to heist. So I really like that touch. Vaults and heists are always something that I think we want to add to our D&D material, but the spells the players have at their disposal make it very difficult to plan properly unless you're a DM who has extensive knowledge of the types of spells that your players have access to.
Yeah, this was very thoughtful. All of the different pieces of this, I think, were well thought out. My favorite part of the thoughtfulness was the encountering the chained library section, where they go through, I think, 10 different ways you could encounter some person that brings you to the library or the concept of the library. And they're all pretty different, and some of them build on each other. So there are many different ways you can meet someone in an adversarial sense, where you have a book and a librarian adventurer comes to try to take it from you. Or you could meet in a more camaraderie space where you're both exploring a dungeon. You have one treasure that you're trying to find in the dungeon or one reason that you're in the dungeon. And then while you're going through the dungeon, you meet an NPC. And that NPC is looking for a specific book that you've never heard of. So I think that's really... There are 10 of these, right? So I think there are really lots of different options for how you can put this in your game that the author planned out very nicely. So I think the thoughtfulness of the defenses of the library are equally interesting to the thought that was put into encountering the library. One of the things I actually like about this thoughtfulness is that the guards in here have their eyes like caved in. They're creatures that have things put into their eyes so they can't read the books. And then you also have librarians who have special glasses such that they can copy down the books for preserving them, but they don't get to read any of it. And you have things such as the librarians go two by two so that no one is tempted to read the books. There's so many thoughtful things point out in the lore of this place that I think makes it a setting that I will put in every campaign I run for the rest of my life.
I think I would have to agree with you. And I would actually basically issue a challenge to any of our listeners out there. If you're someone who wants your world to feel a little bit bigger, to feel a little bit broader and more special, drop an agent of the library into your game as the next NPC that maybe the characters encounter. And maybe at the end of the adventure, they let slip that they are somebody who works for this library and they might have work for your players in the future. And maybe your players never interact with that, which is great. I mean, that's prep that you don't have to do, and it keeps your players beelined on the adventure and the campaign that you had planned. And it serves the purpose of, there is a broader world out there, but we're players, we have choice and agency, and we're deciding not to pursue those plot threads. I think I'd have to agree with you. I can't think of a reason why this library in one form or another won't exist in all of my future campaign settings.
Yeah, one of the points you made, I think, is really, really nice, that this allows you to increase the scope of your world. And I think this is very interesting, because one of the things you can explicitly do in this library is come up with how many different books there are about the history of the world, and also how many different types of world-ending books there are. So if I imagine I have a world where there are tens of thousands of years of mages working through dangerous abilities, then I might have thousands of books that are sentient and angry and want to destroy the world, and that this library houses a huge assortment of these powerful books. And that might make your players feel one way about having found their own sentient book and how big the world becomes when they realize that their small problem was actually, you know, a problem that has been shared throughout ages. And the alternative is to make your players feel very special and to make the world feel very small, where when they go to this library, they see there's only 6 or 7 sentient world-ending books, and they have one of them. And the librarians are extremely keen on getting this very specific book from them. And if they don't, they are worried that the world will end, that the players will lose track of this book and destroy the world as we know it. So I think this idea of playing with scale and making your world bigger is very, very useful here. But you can also make your world smaller by introducing the chained library. I think playing with scale is something that is extremely natural to a place that has the entirety of the knowledge of your campaign in it. You get to decide how big the library is, which means you decide how big the knowledge of your campaign is and how big your setting is. So I think it works out really, really well like that.
And then another piece in this that I really enjoy are the rules that they provide for when your players get their hands on a sentient book. That, like you said, Ariel, has an agenda. So here they have a D6 table for what that agenda could be. Summon a powerful extraplanar entity. So basically, like, summon a god or a demon. Reunite with its former master, a powerful wizard or lich. Destroy an old enemy and everyone they hold dear. Consume 100 other books, gaining power with each one. Bring down a kingdom. Destroy the chained library itself. And they have the rules for how resisting this book works with saving throw DCs and what happens if the spirit of the book overtakes somebody, which I think is hilarious that a player could become a big bad just because they failed a few saving throws on a very, very dangerous but ancient book. And I think you'd have to know what types of players you're playing with to figure out whether or not they would be okay with this happening to their character. I think that my players that I run for would perhaps be a little bit miffed if I didn't foreshadow enough just how dangerous these books are. But I think the payoff of, like, yeah, your character is essentially dead because the other players let them get away and didn't realize that they had been consumed by this book would be a very memorable reveal for those players. And then they'd have to make a new character until they could hunt down and save that character who had been overtaken by the book, who maybe, like, becomes the BBEG at the end. Or I think the players that I play with in Ben's campaign from We Speak Common, I think that any of us, if this were to happen to our character, we would be ecstatic. It's my dream for one of my characters to become the campaign-ending villains one day. And if that means that I lose control of them and they become an NPC, then so be it.
Yeah, I would recommend trying this out with lots of different parties. I really do think being overtaken and subsumed by an extremely powerful magical tome that has been around for hundreds or thousands of years is part of the fantasy that we're looking for when we play D&D. I think even if people want to have characters that last through a long campaign, you can make that work with finding easy ways for them to be saved, or at least ways that they can be saved, maybe not easy ways. But I think that this is a very, very fun experience for lots of different players, so I definitely recommend it. I think there's a couple other parts of this that really make you feel that the agenda of these books is scary and powerful, that the librarians have very strict rules about using the books for good, in that they basically don't. You would have to steal a book or be very, very skillful at convincing the librarians to let you use one of these books, because their rules don't let them use these powerful books for good, because they know the risk is just too great. So I think this is a very natural barrier for your players to encounter, and a very natural place for roleplay and exciting, difficult choices that, is this book really too dangerous? Should we heed the warning of the librarians when they tell us that this book is far too dangerous, even if it could help save our friends? So I think that play of good versus evil and risk, and is it means justify the ends justify the means, all those conversations become very, very interesting in the Chained Library. So I think it's a nuanced type of encounter that you can put in front of your players.
Yeah, no, I love it. And this is a great chapter, and it's definitely in my top five of all time chapters.
Yeah, it's a total winner, which makes me less excited about the next one. Not because it's worse in any way, just because it's less epic to me. It's less exciting. I got less excited by the next chapter than I did by the previous one.
So this next chapter, Ariel and I are have differing opinions about. It's called the On the Road Encounters, Five Traveling Encounters to Drop into Your Game by Derek Ruse. And Ariel, how do you feel about this chapter?
I would just rather not exist. no, it's fine. It's not what I want from Arcadia, and that's okay. I just think that these kinds of small, simple, but nuanced encounters are things that I like to build on my own, or that I like to just get from some other resource. And I want to use the creative energy of the MCDM team for things that change my game. So this library changed my game. The laboratory is a different way of using magic. The elementals, the mounts, all of these things fundamentally change the game that I'm playing. These encounters, I think, are not that. And that's why I'm less appreciative of them. I think they're just kind of taking up space. I read through all of them. They're actually good. Like, they're nuanced and interesting. They have multiple success and failure conditions. And they have chances for... They all have chances for combat, but they also all have chances for roleplay. Like, I think they're good. I just don't care that much about them. I hope that's not too mean to the author.
So I really enjoyed this chapter, and I think that this chapter are five really well scoped encounters that you can drop into your game that are going to perhaps break up some monotony of traveling on the road, which is something that we've discussed in the past. And like you said, Ariel, they are nuanced in that they have opportunity for roleplay and combat, depending on what preference your players have. And I think that they serve as really good examples of what I would kind of describe as Colvillian D&D. And what that means to me is the principles of D&D that are kind of espoused in Matt Colville's Running the Game videos. So an example of what I'm talking about here, I think, is during the last ditch defense encounter, where it talks specifically about the waves that are coming in and what the guards are doing, or how the enemies will actually behave, which I think we see in most Wizards of the Coast material. They tell you what monsters are in the room, and then combat happens, and maybe a second wave of enemies show up at some point. But with this encounter, we're getting very different types of enemies, and they are behaving in specific ways, in that they are taking on roles. Like, some of them are infantry and others are firing from a distance. And I feel like it serves as a really good example for someone who is maybe a new DM and doesn't totally understand how to use creature roles correctly. It gives them an example to go off of, like, oh, this is what a dynamic combat looks like.
It's actually really interesting. I feel like, Ray, you and I don't often agree on our favorite parts of anything, but this was my favorite part by far of the encounters. For all the reasons you described, I just think it's very cool, very different. Like, this is actually something that I don't do so much as a DM. I often have multiple waves, but four is never, I don't think I've ever done four. And three if I'm really pushing it. And this kind of, I think, pushed the envelope of encounter design that I was willing to consider.
And then the other encounters are very similar in that they present the players with something that is a principle that I believe that Matt Colville has like espoused in the past. So there's one where the players basically just come across a moral dilemma. There is a farmer who is being picked on by a noble, and the noble is in the right and has the right of law on their side, but it feels wrong. It feels bad. This person is manipulating the system to gain some advantage, and the players gain nothing by stepping up to defend this farmer. It is not a scenario where the players gain something by doing the right thing. So putting your players in this position where, oh man, especially if one of them is a paladin or a cleric or wants to be like some type of hero or is like values their moral compass, to put them in a position where doing the right thing will only bring them grief, I think is very interesting and will make your players kind of either hate themselves if they don't do the right thing because they know it's not going to be good for their wealth or their clout, and then doing the right thing will feel that much better and that much more heroic once they overcome that hurdle.
I think for all those reasons, it's actually a great moment of fantasy fulfillment. I think there is a big part of fantasy that you do the right thing despite, you know, your own personal gain. And being a great hero of D&D is saving the day because it's the right thing to do. So I think that this is actually perhaps a really cool moment of fantasy fulfillment in that regard, even though there is all this nuance like you talked about. And so it's interesting, and your players do have to make choices, but the payoff, if they do feel like they made the right moral, ethical choice, I think is a great moment of fantasy fulfillment for your players. And if they don't feel like there's a perfectly correct moral choice, that they're standing up for the side of good because the story can be nuanced, then I think they also get an interesting encounter of gray ethical areas. But I really like the idea of standing up for the little guy. I think that's a great moment of fantasy fulfillment that you can provide for your players.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, these encounters, these drop-in encounters, they're nothing fancy like the library, but their simplicity makes them very simple to implement. Like, I could drop one of these into my game next week, no problem, no friction. I wouldn't have to jump through any hoops. Whereas the library, I'm going to have to kind of carefully think that out. Like, which of my NPCs are going to turn out to be librarians for the library? What books are in the library for my world? And I think that this is some very grassroots D&D, which I don't think we maybe see from Matt Colville's Arcadia all that often, because I think it is for GMs and it's for experienced GMs who are looking to bring their game to the next level. This, I think, kind of like brings you back to the basics in a very useful and real way. Because I think that as GMs, sometimes we get caught up in building this huge world with this sprawling story arc that has like all these crazy plot twists, and then before you know it, we're forgetting to add different creature types to our combats. We're forgetting to add obstacles and different terrain to our battle maps that our players are acting with. We get so caught up in scoping out and crafting this grand design that we forget to give that same love to the farmer that the players ran into. Did you forget to give that farmer a name before the session, even though you knew your players were going to meet them because he was just some farmer? Well, maybe that's a sign that you got to get back to the building blocks and make sure that those are polished up.
And I think getting back to these fundamentals is a good way for you as a DM to run low-level D&D and still find well-rounded encounters for your players. I think low-level D&D can actually be difficult to run because your players don't have many options. These are well-designed so that the options that your players are considering are, should I use my combat? Should I use my role-playing? And that is a good way of thinking about low-level character design, not which spells will be interesting for them to use in this case, which combat abilities will be interesting to use, but how do I make it interesting for them if they do swing their sword or if they don't swing their sword? Because they don't have many options other than those two things. So I think it's a good case study in these really simplistic, like you said, low-level character designs. One of the things that I think is a great DM lesson to take from reading this that I had was there's a little tidbit that you can level up these encounters up to level 9. Because starting at level 9, you get 5th level spells. And what they said in this piece is that 5th level spells provide too much flexibility and too much power for these encounters to be actually meaningful and interesting. And so I think that's something to think about as a DM. When you get to the point where your players go from level 6 to 7 and level 8 to 9, what are they now getting? What should you change in your design philosophy? When you make those leaps, you know, maybe they start to get 9th level spells at 17, you make the big leap from 16 to 17. What do you need to change in your DMing style? What do you need to change in your encounter philosophy? I think that was just like a nice note that that's something that the MCDM designers, who are professional designers, are spending time thinking about.
Yeah, I think that I wish I had been more deliberate in when my players leveled from 6 to 7 and then from 8 to 9, because the spells that they suddenly had access to really did change how the campaign needed to work. And now I think they're important enough where their abilities match how important they are. But at the time that they achieved those levels, they didn't yet have the like clout to back up those powers. And there definitely felt like there was a little bit of a mismatch where, oh, these players have these amazing world-changing abilities. How are they not like famous adventurers? Well, it's because my campaign can't have them be famous adventurers yet because it invalidates some of the story that they still need to go through. So paying closer attention to those cliffs, I wish I had done that in my game, and I would encourage other people to maybe keep your players back if your story isn't ready for them to have access to those abilities yet, and give them awesome magic items instead. Like, don't starve your players of cool stuff when they're doing really cool stuff, but perhaps levels are not the way that you reward your players if your story isn't ready for them to have those powers yet.
Right. And one of the ways you can kind of move on your story from getting ready for those higher levels, you're not sure what your campaign needs to change in order to get those higher levels, is putting in travel encounters. To get from point A to point B, you need to think of something you want to do at point B. You're not quite ready for it. You're making a little more plans. Put in one of these travel encounters. They're really good. They're well written. I could even see myself using them. I think I personally like to write my own closer to the time of the session because I like to get inspiration from the things that the characters are doing in the moment. But that doesn't mean I won't use some of these ideas. There's an idea of having 4 waves of attackers and an old quarrel being the reason for why these attackers are coming. I kind of like that. There's another place where kobolds have taken over and you hear the cries of the guards before you get the chance to plan. I like that as a design philosophy. When does the action happen? Does the action happen when you have a lot of time to plan, as in one encounter? Or does the action happen when you're in the moment and you don't have any time to plan? I think those are definitely things I'll use when I'm thinking about design encounters in the future.
I think that it would be kind of funny to put one of these encounters in front of a group of level 14 adventurers and just have them absolutely plow through
yeah.
it.
Just a reminder of what the little world is like.
Exactly. Like, they're traveling on the road, they find this group of merchants who are going to be attacked by bandits in the night to come, and they're like, oh, please help us. And they're like, we'll see what we can do. And then the wizard chain lightnings all the bandits on the first round of combat, or the first turn of combat, and they're just all dead immediately. And your adventurers can just, you're welcome, no problem.
Yeah, it's this idea of scope and improvement. It's something that actually exists in the Fallout games a lot, where the level of difficulty doesn't change as you level up as a character, so that sometimes you'll just go to a place and crush everything, and it's because, like, you could have gone there when in the beginning of the game, but now you're here, and you're powerful, so you get to show off your cool stuff and be in charge, and I think that's very true in D&D as well.
All right, well, that's the end of Arcadia 4 and the end of our review of Arcadia 4. There's 3 articles this time around. I really enjoyed the issue. I'm really excited to see what the future issues will look like now that they're able to act on the feedback that they got back from those articles. And I'm excited to see perhaps a more focused Arcadia.
Yeah, I'm right with you. I think that the future of Arcadia is bright, and the fact that they know what they're going to do, I think will mean that the quality continues to improve.
Yeah, absolutely. So until next time, I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails. If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.